is the Cloud Enough Podcast, your launchpad for Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud Enough Podcast. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
We are two brothers and freelancers focusing 100% on AWS. We are doing security reviews of AWS infrastructures, doing bootstrapping of whole infrastructures for our customers. That's what we do day to day. And every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS in this podcast. Usually, one of us prepares the topic, which is not known to the other one. But this week, this is a little bit different. We talk about all the things you need to know about reInvent in Las Vegas, and we condensed it to the top 10 announcements. And so Michael and me, we have both contributed five announcements that we think are important. And on top of that, we also have three interviews with attendees from reInvent in Las Vegas. So this is why this week's podcast is a little bit different.
Okay, so our first interview is with Alexander, and he is a serverless hero. So let's listen what he has to say, what his favorite announcements are.
So what do you think are the most important releases or the highlights of the last couple of days here at reInvent?
Hello, Michael. It's nice to be here on your podcast. This reInvent was actually super interesting. There was a bunch of new releases and features announced before the reInvent, and now on as the reInvent came, we actually have seen some very interesting announcements in the serverless space. So, for example, I can mention like the provisioned concurrency on AWS Lambda, which is one of the highlights of this reInvent, and also the second one I could say like. Something which is really interesting to me is this Amplify data store, which is really, really, really interesting and a very powerful feature for all AWS customers who are using Amplify.
So I'm very glad you recorded some voices from reInvent in Las Vegas, Michael. And the first one from Alexander, I think, hits a very interesting announcement, which is provision concurrency for AWS Lambda. And I want to dive a little bit deeper into what that means. So why is provision concurrency for Lambda important? I think it's because of two obstacles that we had when building serverless applications. One of them is cold starts. So by default, AWS Lambda scales on demand, which means whenever Lambda needs to spin up a new executor for processing request, it takes something between 100 milliseconds and a second to do so, because they need to spin up the execution environment, download the source code and everything. So this takes a while. So typically, this is not a big issue because it affects only a very small portion of your traffic. So that means it only happens when Lambda needs to spin up new executors, which, depending on your workload, typically happens not that often. So in most use cases, that's not an issue. But in some use cases, having a latency above 100 or 200 milliseconds is not acceptable, even not for a small portion of your traffic. And this was always a showstopper for building a serverless application with AWS Lambda. And what AWS announced at reInvent is now provision concurrency. So what we do now is we can provision a specific amount of memory, which also provisions CPU or network, that is then used for executing our requests for the Lambda function. And actually the infrastructure, the executors are pre-warmed, so they are already running, they are waiting for incoming requests. And as long as you're not using more capacity than you have provisioned, you will not see any cold starts anymore. And also you will not see these cold starts, these latencies between 100 milliseconds and a second anymore, or let's maybe be more accurate, you will see them very, very seldomly. And so this is, I think, very important. And so there's a blog post from AWS that we will link in the show notes that actually measures these latencies and does a benchmark between Lambda functions with and without provision concurrency. And you can see from there, yeah, that it really helps to reduce or to equal the latencies of your Lambda function.
Okay, so that sounds great, Andreas. And this was also one of my top announcements. So can you go a little bit more into the details? So is this really a feature that we can use? So can you tell us a little bit about the general availability? Is it available in all regions? And what about cloud formation support?
Yes. So the good news, it is general available in all regions. And you can also provision it with CloudFormation. So it's really ready to use. So there's one another interesting aspect of provision concurrency. And this is, it does not only affect your Lambda functions from a technical perspective, but it also affects your AWS bill. Because by provisioning concurrency for your Lambda function, you also get a discount of about 15%. And if you have listened to our last episode, where we were talking about AWS savings plans, this is a very similar concept than we have with EC2 instances and Lambda. So we provision the infrastructure that we need to use, and we are paying for it no matter if we use it or not. But on the other hand, we're getting a discount on the usual on-demand price. So with provision concurrency, it's about 50% of the on-demand price. So which means as long as you keep the utilization of your provision concurrency at about or over 60%, it's less, you pay less for running your your application on Lambda than you do with the on-demand pricing. Actually, the funny thing is, so if you use this new feature and provision concurrency for your AWS Lambda function, you then are again in the business of actually managing your infrastructure capacity, because you then have to make sure that you are provisioned the right amount of capacity all the time. So yeah, again, you're losing some benefits of being serverless. On the other side, you get a small price reduction and also reduce the cold starts.
Yeah, so one thing that I did not understand probably at the beginning is that if I, for example, reserve, if I provision one concurrency unit and I use more than that, then it still works. So I will pay the on-demand rate and there might be a cold start, but it's not like an upper limit. There's also the concurrency limit that you can set. So this is the way to restrict the number of concurrent functions or execution environments that run. But with provision concurrency, it's really only like the minimum that you basically provision, but you can always scale above this provisioned limit.
Yeah, so if that's true. If you compare it to EC2, it's maybe a savings plan with a reservation, capacity reservation. So that's more or less what it relates to in the old world.
Okay, Andreas. So that's it. Is this all we need to know about provision concurrency, or is there anything else to mention?
No, I think that's the most important aspect. And I'm very happy about this announcement, because I think it allows us to use serverless in more scenarios than it has been before. So I'm happy with that.
Okay, I see. So next announcement, and this was also mentioned by Alexander, and this is about the Amplify Data Store, and this is actually one of the announcements that I really like. So what is the Amplify Data Store? So first, Amplify is a framework and also tooling from AWS to help us build applications. It works for browser-based applications, but it also works for iOS and Android-based applications. So with Data Store, we get a capability to Basically, we get an API to access a local data store. So we can write data to this data store. We can read it from the data store. And we can also subscribe to changes. So if something is changed in the data store, we can react to that. And so on the browser side, it is implemented on top of IndexedDB. So it's stored inside the browser. So if you restart your browser, you will still have access to your data. So that's the like the local part of the Amplify data store. And the cool thing, and this is, I think, what a lot of people will use it for, is you can also connect the data store, or you can sync it to the cloud. And by syncing it to the cloud, you can also sync it across devices. So you can connect from multiple clients. So for example, you can use your iPad app. You can also use the iPhone app. And you will see after the synchronization is finished, you will see the same data. And the way this is implemented, it's all based on the GraphQL schema that you create in Amplify. And what happens under the hood is that Amplify, or the Amplify CLI to be more precise, will deploy an AppSync backend and DynamoDB tables for you. So for each type that you define in the GraphQL schema, you will get a DynamoDB table. And they will care, or AWS Amplify will take care of all the data synchronization issues. So you can configure the strategy that is used for merging the items if there is a conflict. So for example, if you change an item on your iPad while you're offline, and also on your iPhone while you are offline, and if both the devices come online again, if they modified the same piece of data, there needs to be some way to figure out what the latest state is. And there are multiple strategies that you can choose from. And there's also, and what I really like, the possibility to invoke a Lambda function to resolve the conflict in the data. So if you're not happy with the available strategies for merging the data, you can also implement your own logic, which is nice. I think not a lot of people will use it, but still you could if there's a need for it. And by default, the merge is quite clever. So because it knows about the schema of the data, so it can take this into account and make a little bit like better informed decisions about merging two items together. So as always, So do you have any questions, Andreas?
Yeah, so my question is, did I get it correct that actually at the back end it is DynamoDB tables, and what Amplify Data Store brings along is the CLI and then actually an SDK that manages all the data synchronization. So, but the back end is still a DynamoDB table and a GraphQL API. Is that correct?
Yes, and the back end is deployed into your AWS account. So this is something that you can see. So it's not really a Amplify API or something like this. It's a plain AppSync backend, and it's backed by DynamoDB tables. Yes.
Okay, and it's actually not a real service. It's more an SDK or more, an integration on the client side for DynamoDB and AppSync that has been there before.
Yes. So that's also what I would what I think it is. Yeah. So the cool thing is, it is general available for browsers. It is not general available for iOS and Android. So for iOS and Android, it's in preview. So if you are building a browser-based app, you can start, because it's also available in all regions. So that's good news. So there's no need to talk about CloudFormation here, because Amplify is managed with the Amplify CLI. And so that is working out of the box.
Okay, perfect. So this was the second announcement of our top 10. So let me continue with the third announcement that we picked for our All You Need to Know About AWS podcast episode. And this is HTTP APIs. This is a new service that AWS has announced. It lives under the API Gateway umbrella, I would say. So it's a service inside another service. And as the name implies, HTTP API allows us to build REST APIs For example, with AWS Lambda, and I think it's actually designed for the use with AWS Lambda. And it solves two problems that we had with the existing solution, which was the API gateway, which was very hard to configure, and it was also quite costly, actually. So what the HTTP APIs are solving is it's much easier to configure, and it also costs less than API gateway. So HTTP APIs come with a small but powerful set of features. You can forward incoming requests to AWS Lambda or another HTTP endpoint. But what the HTTP APIs are doing is they just forward your requests. So it's just a proxy that forwards your request to Lambda or any other HTTP endpoint. By default, it supports cross-origin resource sharing and authentication and authorization with JWT. So this is the mechanism that is built in for authentication and authorization. And you can use your own domain names as well as configure TLS and SSL. So that's the small feature set. So I think it's a very powerful tool with a limited feature set that is just designed for this specific use case you want to build a REST API backed by Lambda functions. So I think that's very helpful. You can configure the resources and the methods of your HTTP API, or you can just forward every incoming request to your Lambda function, do all the logic there. That's totally up to you. There is no request validation. There is no templating for mapping requests and responses. That's up to the API gateway, and HTTP APIs just cover that basic use case that we need. So important to know is that HTTP APIs are not generally available. They are in preview or in beta. It's not available in all regions, but, and that's the good news, you can already set it up with CloudFormation. And I want to say that there is one important feature missing, and this is throttling. So at the moment, there is no way to rate limit requests per client in any way. So that is typically a big issue if you build a backend and you're not able to throttle the incoming requests.
Yeah, so also something that I really like, because I actually tried using HTTP APIs already using CloudFormation. So with API Gateway, whenever you made a change to the configuration, you had to create a deployment. And with the new HTTP APIs, that's no longer needed, because you can enable a feature called auto deploy. So whenever you make a change, it will automatically create a new deployment, so you do not have to care about this anymore. So the bad news is that I was actually not able to get it working. So I did some changes to the CloudFormation template. The example blog post is, as far as I see, the permissions are not correct there. Like, the example is wrong, and it's not working for me. So I opened a support request and no response so far. So yeah, not sure if it's actually working or what I'm doing wrong, because there are not a lot of examples, and the examples that are there are wrong. So yeah, so that's kind of not as good experience as I hoped. But yeah, so let's see. Maybe this will be fixed in the future. Okay, Andreas, I think, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but as far as I understood, HTTP APIs, they are also cheaper compared to the API gateway. Is this correct?
Yes, that's one purpose why they build it. Because I think it's not very cost effective to build serverless applications with the API gateway, for example, also compared to the ALB integration for Lambda. So I think that is why the API gateway team had the pressure to build a product that really is competitive from a pricing perspective as well. Yeah, it's cheaper than API gateway.
Okay, so let's continue with the next announcement. And this is also about reducing costs. And this time when you use step functions. So we have a new feature called Express Workflows, and the idea is that compared to what is now called the standard type of step function, the Express type can scale up to over 100,000 executions per second. So this is really designed for high volume, and it also is, as I said, less expensive than the standard workflows. But if you use the Express workflows, there will be some limitations compared to the standard workflows. The first is an execution can only take up to 5 minutes. So with a like standard workflow, I think you have up to 1 year. With the Express workflow, you only have 5 minutes. So they are really designed for workloads like ingesting data into your system, or reacting to an HTTP, like connecting it to HTTP APIs. So this is kind of the idea of the new Express workflows, to have high volume but short duration kind of executions. The other change is that you do not longer see the executions in the step functions API. So instead, they appear in CloudWatch logs. So you configure the log group, and then the execution data is sent to CloudWatch logs instead of a history that you can access over the step functions API. And I think the major change or the major difference is that we now have an at least once execution guarantee instead of exactly once what you get with the standard type of step function. So that's, I think, a major change here. And also, there are a few things that are not possible with the Express workflows. First is just basically no support for synchronous invocations of other services. And also the callback kind of type where you wait for task tokens, which is, for example, interesting if you wait for user input. So they are not supported. And also the activities are not supported. So this is a way to basically do some work on, for example, EC2 instances or other systems.
So I have a question here. So that does that mean that when they do not support job run or callback patterns, does that mean that, for example, also calling AWS Fargate tasks is not supported? So when I start a job and then wait for it to execute, this is not supported, or is that something else?
So you can start a Fargate task, but you cannot wait for it to finish. So basically, the synchronous way is not available. Only the asynchronous way of invoking the Fargate task is available. So you cannot do things like I think you wrote a blog post about how to run Fargate triggered by cron jobs. And so this is not possible with the Express workflows.
Okay. So at the moment, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where I can use this Express workflow, because at least in the scenarios where I have been using step functions, this was the feature that I wanted to use, right? I wanted to be able to do synchronous job runs and to benefit from the exactly once guarantee. So at the moment, I cannot think of a scenario, but there might be one in the future when I think about it, when building an architecture. Yeah, okay, interesting.
Yeah, so I think one use case that came to my mind, so we have this template to trigger the CloudFormation drift detection mm-hmm. for all the stacks. So I think that's a use case where we could easily switch to the Express workflows and we would save some money. But besides that, I think we rely on the exactly once guarantee. So in many places where we use them, so yeah, we cannot switch there.
Or another thing that comes to my mind. So if the maximum execution duration is 5 minutes, so I can also run the same thing in a Lambda function, right? So what is, it's hard for me to imagine why I use that service, but.
Yes. So, I mean, we will see how useful it is in the real world. So the good news is that, so step function, the state machines are defined in I think it's called Amazon state language or something like this. So it's a JSON with a certain schema. And Express workflows use exactly the same schema, so they didn't invent something new, so they reused what was already there. So it's really easy to migrate. It's just changing the type to Express, basically. And it is generally available. It is available in all regions, and it is also supported by CloudFormation. So you can actually start using it right after the podcast, and there are no obstacles to wait for. Okay, so yes, I think it's time for the next interview, Andreas. What do you think?
Yes, that would be great, Michael. So who is next?
I talked to Anders, and he is a AWS community hero. So he has some experience with AWS, and he also listened to all the keynotes in Las Vegas. So let's see what he has to say.
Well, it's like hard to pick your favorite kid. There's been a lot of interesting announcements, but the most surprising one was, of course, Deep Composer. After that, I think I would kind of look at a suite of new announcements, which is all announcements related to Redshift and machine learning, because I think that was a kind of a broad suite of new stuff, which will have customer impacts. Lots of other cool announcements here, but they are kind of narrow, so they will impact on few customers, but not necessarily all of them, I think. I think that's the takeaway for the keynotes and the announcements this year. Even though, small disclaimer, there might be some news I haven't seen yet, because they're popping up news all over the place.
Okay, so I think there are interesting features that were mentioned. So one is the ML integration into Redshift, and it is also integrated into Aurora, the database engine. So basically what you can do here is you can make or you can invoke machine learning capabilities from within your SQL query. So they added functions. So you can, for every row in the table, you can invoke, for example, the like algorithm to detect the sentiment or things like this. So it's really, I think it just got easier to integrate it. Before that, you had to, like, basically in your application logic, you had to iterate over all the rows and then invoke the machine learning part in your own application logic. Now you can do it directly from the database, so which I think could really be interesting for some use cases. So Andreas Anders mentioned Deep Composer. So do you have any idea or any thoughts about what this Deep Composer thing is about?
Yes, so Michael, I've looked at this series, and this is really a funny one. So Deep Composer is actually composing music. So what you need to provide as an input for the service is a small snippet. For example, play a melody with the piano, and then you upload that to Deep Composer, and it then composes a song out of it. So with multiple instruments, and you then download the song and can listen to it. So I listened to the examples from the AWS blog posts. I'm not sure if I really like what comes out of it, but at least it sounds like music and it sounds familiar. So I think it's interesting what they're doing there. I think it's mostly a showcase of what you can do with machine learning. I don't know if there is a real business use case to use it, but it's interesting, actually.
Yeah, so I think I also kind of compared to something that I learned about, which was a way to, you basically inserted an image, and then the algorithm converted it into something that looked like it if it was painted by Van Gogh. So, and this is kind of what Deep Composer does for music. But yeah, I think it's more like a way to get people using the machine learning algorithms, but I also don't really see some like business impact here. So, okay, Andreas, so what is the next announcement that you want to share with us?
So the next announcement that I that came to my attention is inter-region peering with Transit Gateway. So let me describe what this is about. So the AWS Transit Gateway was introduced last year at reInvent, and it actually makes it much easier to peer multiple networks with each other. So you just have the Transit Gateway that manages the connections between UVPCs in different accounts, different regions, UVPN or Direct Connect connections. And actually with Transit Gateway, you can build the routing between all these networks, and it makes it much easier, especially for very large organizations, but also for small ones. So what was missing so far is it was not possible to peer networks across different regions with Transit Gateway. We had that capability with VPC peering. So this was what we had before Transit Gateway. There we could peer networks, VPCs across regions, but it was not available with Transit Gateway. And now AWS announced that feature. So it's now possible to peer your VPCs in different regions. At the moment, not all regions are supported. So it's supported in US East, North Virginia, Ohio, Oregon, and in the EU in Ireland and in Frankfurt. So it's not available everywhere yet, but in the future it probably will be. So it allows you to peer all your VPCs with each other and, for example, use one VPN connection, one side-to-side VPN connection or Direct Connect connection to your data center, for example. I think that's a small improvement, but very interesting improvement. And we have some customers that roll out their infrastructure globally in multiple regions, and it's a very interesting feature for them, for example, to build their control networks so that it's easier to connect to instances in all of those regions and stuff like that. So important to note it, the inter-region peering is general available. As I mentioned, it's not available in all regions. And as far as I can tell, it's also not included in CloudFormation yet. Still very interesting topic.
Yeah, so this is also one of the interesting parts of CloudFormation, or because I'm not quite sure how they handle all this cross-region stuff in CloudFormation. Mm-hmm. Because so far, the resources in CloudFormation are always deployed to the same region than the stack lives in. But now we really have to, in many cases, we have to add configuration data in many regions. And there's not really a good solution for that in CloudFormation. So I'm kind of interested how they will fix that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Probably they won't fix it, but yeah, let's see. Okay, so what's next, Michael? What else do you have on your list?
Yeah, so the announcement that was kind of popping up and I was curious about is AppConfig. And AppConfig is a new feature or a new service that allows us to deploy configuration data to environments in a controlled and safe manner. So what do I mean by controlled and safe? So first, you can validate the configuration data. So if someone enters new configuration data, you can make sure that it is somehow valid. So you could, or you can either use a JSON schema to kind of make sure that the data or the input is valid. And with the JSON schema, you can do things like checking minimum and maximum values of an integer, or you can also only define what values have to be there, and things like this, what the type of the data is. You can also invoke a Lambda function, so you can execute custom logic to validate the input. So for example, you can check if you enter the name of an SSM parameter in your configuration data, you can then execute a Lambda function to really make sure that this SSM parameter has a value. Or things like this. So there's a lot of possibilities. By default, JSON schema is the easiest one, but you can also do whatever you like in the Lambda function. And then if you enter the new configuration data and if it's valid, you can roll it out into environments. And the rollout is done in a step-by-step manner, so you can configure basically how long it should take. So, for example, you want to have a 10-minute time window, and every step in this time window, you want to roll out the changes to 20% of the instances, for example. And also what you can do is you can configure that app config observe and CloudWatch alarm. And if the CloudWatch alarm fires within or while the deployment of the new configuration is going on, it automatically rolls back the changes, and the old, like the previous configuration is then rolled out again to the machines. So the configuration data itself is either stored on as an SSM parameter, or you can store it in an SSM document. So they invented a new type. So like documents can have different types. So there's a new type for configuration data. And for me, like the obvious place to store a JSON file was S3, but that's not supported. So you can either put it into an SSM parameter or into an SSM document. So that's what you can do. So the biggest surprise, and this is also kind of not really obvious from reading through the blog post, is that you really have to integrate app config into your applications. So basically, you have to call the get configuration API every now and then and pull app config to see if the configuration data has changed. And in the blog post that comes together with this episode, I have some like Node.js code that basically pulls app config every 15 seconds for new configuration data. And the application also has to, you also have to have some mechanism inside your application to distribute the new configuration state internally. So most applications read configuration data when they start, and then it's not able to change the configuration anymore. So your application really has to support this kind of way to change configuration data while the application is running. But still, I really like the service, and for some cases, it could be really interesting. So you could, for example, implement something like feature toggles with it. You can also, where you can like change the configuration and set feature A to true or feature B to false and things like this. I mean, it's not, as I mentioned, feature toggles, it's not a service that supports feature toggles. It's a service that supports deploying configuration, and you could use it to implement feature toggles. So yeah, we will see. So it is general available. It's available in all regions, and it's not supported by CloudFormation at the moment. So either way, I think we have to wait a few more weeks or months until we see supporting CloudFormation. Then we can start figuring out what we can use it for. And there's also some like kind of confusion because app config, it is actually called AWS app config, but it's part of AWS Systems Manager. So I'm not really sure why it's part of AWS Systems Manager.
Of course it is.
So the AWS SSM CLI does not cover app config. It's AWS app config. So there's an own service name for it, but it's, yeah, I'm not sure. So that's a little bit confusing. And it's also, so if you use app config, you will have to pay for it. So it's not free. So some parts of Systems Manager are free, but app config is not. So you have to take this into account.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Very interesting new announcement. I totally missed that one. So glad you bring it up. We'll have a look. I think it's, I'm always a little bit concerned when using such a configuration management tool, because usually I prefer building a deployment pipeline to do configuration changes. But I think for some use cases, as you mentioned, it could be very interesting. So thanks for that. So the next thing that you definitely need to know about AWS reInvent is some new features for the application load balancer that are quite interesting. I want to dive into those a little bit deeper. So the first new announcement is the application load balancer introduced a new algorithm to distribute incoming requests among your targets. So far, the only available algorithm was round robin. So just, yeah, each request that comes in is distributed to another machine and then just goes through all the machines and sending them the same amount of traffic. The problem with that approach is that sometimes you have requests that are more expensive than others. So let's think about they consume more CPU capacity or something like that. And what you will end up with if you use round robin, you will have some hot targets in your infrastructure, because some of your targets will or might receive more expensive requests than others. And this results in you have to actually over-provision your targets, so your EC2 instances or containers. And that means, yeah, you're paying more than you actually need to, because the load balancer is not really making sure that the workload on each machine is distributed equally. And what the application load balancer announced is a new algorithm that we can use, and it's called least outstanding requests. So which means the load balancer keeps track of the number of requests that the targets are processing at the moment, and it sends new requests to those targets that have the shortest backlog of incoming requests. So by doing that, the workload gets distributed more evenly in terms of the utilization of your targets. So not every target receives the same amount of requests, but still the utilization should be more equal. And that allows you to then reduce the over-provisioning of your instances or containers. So I think that's a very powerful announcement. This is general available. It's built into CloudFormation already, and it's available in all regions. So you can just start using it by reconfiguring your load balancer. Okay, so this was one announcement of the application load balancer. And the other interesting announcement is that the application load balancer now supports weighted target groups. That allows us to do blue-green deployments, for example. Because what you can do is you can have two target groups behind your application load balancer for the same rule. And you can then decide, I want to, for example, have 25% of my traffic go to this target group and 75% going to another target group. And by doing that, you can switch your traffic from the old version of your application to the instances or containers running the new version of the your application. And the handy thing here is that the load balancer is doing the switching of the traffic between the target groups, which means you don't have to worry about DNS caching, and you can roll back very quickly to the old target group with the old version, for example. So it's actually designed, I think, mostly for building deployments, and that's a very handy feature that is now available on the application load balancer.
Yeah, I agree. So I also saw that it is possible. So kind of what the sticky session is made for, it's also possible so to send the same client to the same target group, even though if it's weighted. So you can. So I think there's a second cookie introduced, and as long as the client sends the cookie to the load balancer, it will always make sure that once the target group is selected, it will always reach the same target group, which makes a lot of sense.
That's also needed for doing a deployment of a new version, because you don't want to switch between new versions for each and every request. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's listen to the next and also the last interview. So this time I interviewed Thorsten, so he's a community hero as well.
So I think, the new Code Guru is a really cool service, and I'm really looking forward to trying it out. And all the ML stuff is really interesting, so I'm really looking forward to take a deep dive and see what this is all about and how this is working and helping users adopt machine learning.
Okay, can you go a little bit into the details? What exactly is Code Guru? So what's the benefit of using it? Can you explain it a little bit to our listeners?
So Code Guru seems to be a new service that helps you look at pull requests to your code currently on Code Commit and GitHub, and it analyzes using machine learning how the code is, how the code quality is, what the common mistakes are in the code, and provides comments on the pull requests with things to solve and to improve code quality.
Okay, great. That sounds very awesome. And thank you very much for your comment, Thorsten.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so I was really happy about Code Guru, the announcement of Code Guru. until I figured out that it only works for Java at the moment, so I cannot really use it, but I think we will see support for other languages in the future. And as soon as I see some support for JavaScript, I'm happy to use it.
There's one funny thing about CodeGuru. So you pay per line of code that the service is reviewing. So removing comments from your code is actually a way to reduce costs. So not sure what to think about that. Okay.
They shouldn't charge for like lines with comments, so that doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay, so the next announcement, or one of my favorites, and now we enter the container space. So there were lots of announcements in the container space, and what I really like is a new feature of Fargate called spot pricing. So we received two amazing features to save money running Fargate workloads. The first feature was compute savings plans, where you can save up to 20 to 52%, depending on how long, like if it's 1 or 3 year commitment and if you pay upfront or not. So this was a great way to reduce costs. And now with spot pricing, you can save up to 69% compared to the on-demand rate. So spot pricing is great if your workloads are interruption tolerant, as AWS calls it. So this means the spot market is basically AWS sells capacity that is not used at the moment, but whenever the capacity is requested, the spot workloads will be terminated and you'll receive a termination notice 2 minutes before the actual termination happens. And the termination notice is available, so they will send the sick term signal to your process, and you will also receive an event or CloudWatch events. And then you could kind of react and shut down your application properly and clean up all the necessary stuff. So I think we now can use savings plans to cover the baseline of workloads that are not happy if they are interrupted, and we can use spot for all the rest. And by using the two features, Fargate becomes really a more attractive option in terms of the pricing, because we get closer to the EC2 pricing model. Unfortunately, we have to wait for CloudFormation support. It's general available. It's available in all the regions where Fargate is available, but yeah. CloudFormation support is missing at the moment. And also something to mention here is that if you're interested into how savings plans work, then listen to the previous podcast episode where we go into details and explain the new savings plans feature. Okay, Andreas, so I think it's time for the last your last announcement.
Yeah, so I picked an announcement that I'm very happy about, and this is Fargate for EKS, so the Kubernetes service offered by Amazon Web Services. And so it was announced over a year ago at reInvent in Las Vegas last year, and finally Fargate is not only available for ECS but also for EKS. So that is actually, I think, a very cool thing, because managing virtual machines to run containers on top of that is actually not a very good idea, in my opinion, because you're building another abstraction layer and you have to manage both layers when you do it your own, running it on virtual machines. And so with Fargate, that's really a game changer. And as you've seen with our book, Rapid Docker on AWS, for example, we are very big fans of using Fargate, because it really changes everything. Of course, you just use the containers, the abstraction layer that you deploy to your cloud provider. So unfortunately, with Fargate available for AKS, I don't have a strong argument for not using AKS and favor ECS, but that's how it is, and I'm very happy that the compute layer is available. So Fargate pricing is the same no matter if you orchestrate the containers with ECS or with AKS, so that's fine. The only difference is when you use AKS, you pay for the cluster, and this is around $144 per month. And as you know, ECS clusters are free of charge. Then the next question is, how does AWS integrate Fargate with AKS? And what you need to run your containers on Fargate is you need to upgrade your Kubernetes version to 1.14 and the platform version to 5. And by doing so, you then can create a so-called Fargate profile that tells the cluster to launch your pods on Fargate for a particular namespace. So you define, for example, for the default namespace, launch the containers on Fargate. And if you want to, you can also limit that and define specific tags that then decide, or that the cluster then uses to decide whether the pod should launch on Fargate or by default on the nodes in your cluster that you manage yourself. So yeah, I think Fargate for AKS is really a big announcement. It's general available, but it's not available in all regions yet. So it's at the moment available in 5 regions, and at the moment there is no support for CloudFormation. That's all about Fargate for AKS. So Michael, what is your last announcement that you picked for our top 10 announcements?
Yeah, so the last announcement is really solving an issue that was kind of driving me crazy for years. And we finally have a way to do proper autoscaling for ECS clusters that are backed by EC2 instances. So we wrote a few blog posts, and we also have like a CloudFormation template that tries to do the best possible way of autoscaling for ECS clusters. But now with ECS cluster autoscaling, basically or finally AWS integrates ECS with the autoscaling group. So what happens under the hood is basically ECS requests the autoscaling group to scale up, which is very handy. So you don't have to add CloudWatch alarms or things like this. And if there's not enough capacity in the cluster, it will scale up the EC2 instances, and still the task will be waiting to be scheduled. So before that, with all the ways that we could create as users of AWS, there were also always the possibility of the cluster running out of capacity, and then tasks were failing because they couldn't be scheduled. So the new construct that is introduced is called a so-called capacity provider. And this is also kind of what is needed for Fargate Spot to work. And the problem with the new concept or the new resource of the capacity provider is that it's not in CloudFormation. So we really have to wait for CloudFormation support. But it is generally available, and it's available in all regions. So as soon as we have CloudFormation support, we can try it out, and we will also make sure that we update our open source template and use the new autoscaling capabilities and that ECS launched. Okay, so that's it. So our 10 announcements or preferred or favorite announcements from this year's reInvent. If you like our podcast, we really like if you would share it with a friend. Please rate or review our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. So, for example, on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Also, if you like to get updates about new episodes, make sure that you subscribe to our podcast. So this is free of charge. And if you subscribe, you will automatically get new episodes as soon as they are released.
Okay, important as well is there is a blog post that covers the same topics than this podcast episode. So if you want to reread what we have been talking about, you will find a link in the show notes. And we also want to announce our online seminar, Rapid Docker on AWS. So this will be a four-week author-led online seminar by Michael and me. It includes videos, screencasts, and you will learn together with a small learning group about how to bring your application dockerized to AWS. We will have weekly question and answer sessions, and this whole online seminar starts in February next year. So reserve your seat now. You will find a link in the show notes. And I think that's it, Michael. That's all you need to know about AWS reInvent. And speak to you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Yes. See you soon. Bye.